Welcome to The Deep End by On Deck, a podcast where visionary builders, creators, and experts discuss world-changing ideas. I'm your host, Marshall Kozloff. Let's dive in.
Your event team flow, you walk to the middle of the co-working area. You can say hi to your team. So it's like a nice moment that you share with your team. Sometimes you have a little chit chat for 5 minutes. Like, hey, what did you do last night? What's up? Maybe some people's like, hey, I was looking for you. Do you have 2 minutes to chat about this? Then, you know, you can work by yourself. You can either go to your own office to be by yourself, or you can co-work silently with the rest of your team around the open office. And then when you have meetings, you go to the project rooms. You enter it, all your content is here, you meet with people there, you take your notes there, you whiteboard there and all of that. And then towards the end of the day, you can join, for example, the game room or the cafeteria in your office where the rest of your team is hanging out, perhaps having a beer, and you can play games with them.
At The Deep End, we're creating a space where we skip the surface level and go in depth into ideas that matter. I'll be your guide as we explore possible futures of commerce, higher education, art, governance, longevity, and more. Joining me this week in The Deep End is Florence Crivello. Flo is the founder and CEO of TeamFlow, a company that's building a virtual office for your team to hang out and collaborate in. Today's conversation is about the future of remote work and the tools needed to literally get the job done. As Joe Albanese, CEO of Stir, said in a past Deep End episode, new behaviors always emerge before the tooling is developed that can enable us to do our best work. While tools like Slack and Zoom aided our sudden transition to remote work when the pandemic hit, Flo believes that a new way of working calls for an entirely new set of tools. In this conversation, we explore how employers can curate a new kind of space that looks virtual, but feels intimate and collaborative in the same way a traditional office does. Our wide-ranging conversation covers text-based productivity versus video-based work, the entrance of Facebook into the remote workspace, the implications of visa immigrations in a borderless world, and much more. To follow Flo's progress, take a tour of TeamFlow at teamflowhq.com. Be sure to check Flo out on Twitter at altimor, altimor. The Deep End is produced by On Deck, where top talent goes to accelerate their ideas and careers. We hope that those who listen to the ideas on the show are inspired to build. To learn more about On Deck's programs, visit beyonddeck.com. For show notes and additional resources related to The Deep End, check out ideas.beyonddeck.com. All right, let's dive in. Flo Crivello, welcome to The Deep End.
Thanks, great to be here.
Let's start here, especially because it's right on the nose of the topic of remote work and your company, TeamFlow. What is your personal working style? To give you context, I've recently discovered that I love WeWorks. I love getting a hot desk and going in 1 to 2 times a week, spending the rest of my time at home on Slack. How do you think about your remote working style?
I think it's actually very fluid. I spend the vast majority of my days on TeamFlow. And so I think by virtue of having my entire team here, I am in back-to-back meetings all day, but I also have these holes somewhere in between the meetings sometimes. And so that does allow me to hang out with my team in the middle of the co-working space. So, you know, to ask a quick update, it's like, hey, like, Bob, what's going on with this project? What's going on with that? That allows me to quickly pull a member of the team to a meeting where I think they should be. So my working style, I mean, obviously, as most entrepreneurs, it's mostly meetings is the medium where I enact change in the organization. But I think with that twist on them, which is that extra fluidity and flexibility inside the meetings.
And another question I love asking people, because it tells a lot about who they are and the way they see the world or want to see the world, at least. If you think of the ideal post-COVID lockdown, so after June 2020, what does that ideal workflow, workspace look like at a level above TeamFlow? Because obviously we'll get into TeamFlow for a second, but I would just love to hear how you think about that. So I think of folks who say no commutes, or I'm 100% back in the office. How do you think about that?
I mean, it's a level above TeamFlow, but not that above. I mean, it's obviously remote all the way. I think there's very little doubt left in anyone's minds that remote is the future. It's just such a panacea. It's commute is one of the worst things that you can do to yourself, you know, in terms of your well-being, in terms of your health, in terms of everything. And remote just removes the commute altogether. So that's the value prop on the employee side. On the employer side, one of the worst problems that employers have is access to talent and hiring. Every entrepreneur, you ask them what's the top three list of problems, remote or like hiring is going to be in there, and remote just solves this issue. So I firmly believe that the future of work is remote. Perhaps after the pandemic, we will go through a funky hybrid period. But I think that over the long term, on like a 10 to 20 years horizon, it's all going to be remote.
So let's actually get into this, which we typically don't do on most Deep End episodes, but the actual mechanics of what team flow is, especially this is because we're doing this in an audio medium, really describe what team flow is. And then after you do that, it'd be great to hear, we can guess what inspired you to create team flow. There was this whole, and we're in this whole pandemic thing, but what were the specific processes that led you into creating the company itself?
Yes. So for context, TeamFlow is a virtual office. So the idea is that you see a literal virtual office floor plan that you can customize, you can put furniture on it, you can make it yours. And then you see your video on a bubble in this virtual office floor plan. And you can move your bubble using your mouse or your keyboard, like in a video game. And you can only hear or be heard by people around you. So that means that if you want to chat with someone, instead of looking for some time on their calendar or looking for their name on Slack and so forth, you just drag yourself over their bubble and you can just say hi immediately. The way I had the idea, there were a few moments, but I think one of the most important moments is my background is I used to be a product manager. I worked for 5 years at Uber. And there was one point at Uber when my team temporarily went remote because we were launching in a lot of cities at the same time. And there was that one day when we had a technical outage. So the app didn't work anymore, the app that I was working on. And it wasn't my first outage, but something about this one made it especially painful. And I later realized that it was the fact that we were remote. So when you have a technical outage, the situation is evolving very rapidly, right? And so you need to coordinate very quickly your engineers with your support agents, with your marketing, with all of these people, right? And I think the fact of not sitting inside the same room and having only Zoom as our tool made it so much more painful to deal with this outage as the situation evolved, right? And so I remember at the end of that day, I was leaning back against my chair and I was about to cry. I was like, this was such a nightmarish day. And I was wondering what is it that made this day such a nightmare? And I realized it's remote, right? And so that's when I had this idea of, oh, we need a more fluid environment where we can collaborate together than just Zoom meeting after Zoom meeting after Zoom meeting. And so after I left Uber in 2019, I took a long personal break. And then everybody always asks me, did you start TeamFlow because of the pandemic? And it's funny because I did start after the pandemic, but in a way that was completely unrelated to the pandemic. I read a blog post written by John Palmer, who was a designer at Snap. And he wrote that amazing blog post that's called Spatial Interfaces. And he extols the virtues of spatial software in it. And there is almost this call to action in the blog post that is, I wonder what would a spatial Zoom look like? And I was like, oh, that's a good question. So I kind of started hacking together a spatial Zoom that night. And at like 3 or 4 a.m., I had a working prototype. And then I basically just got sucked in. And then very quickly, some friend investors of mine told me, Flo, you're out of your mind. Like, there is a pandemic right now. Everybody is going remote. This is like a VC-fundable startup. You should make it a full-time business. And so it kind of happened very organically like that.
What I love about this answer, aside from the fact that it leads directly into my next question, is that it helps provide us a rubric for thinking about what I'm about to ask you, which is, I'm sure you remember, depending where you were based, from March to June 2020, when everyone is uniformly locked down, there are a lot of really big ideas about how COVID was going to change everything. New York City is going to die. Every second tier college is going to close. Therefore, insert really big move, really big statement about how the world is going to change. So what I was going to ask you is, how do you as a founder suggest people think about starting companies and focusing on ideas when you're in the middle of this transitional period and there's all these big opportunities, but you've basically given us a bit of a rubric, and I'm curious what your answer would be, because what you've suggested is you were addressing a problem which actually existed before COVID. So it wasn't as if you were trying to wake up in April and say, what's something fashionable that I could start? You had already identified the thing to focus on, but I just love how you think about this problem, especially back in March through June 2020.
Yeah. And you know, actually, it's funny because when it comes to deciding on this startup idea, I had a few ideas in my mind and I had been doing a bunch of reading. I was kind of a self-funded entrepreneur in residence, if you will. I was just doing a lot of market research and spreadsheeting and market sizing and all of that stuff. And I ended up stumbling almost upon this idea. And so I think my takeaway was that it's a balance between being pragmatic on the one hand, it's like answering immediate need. And in a way that is oriented towards a much larger vision and a much larger moonshot, if you will. So, and I think it's more oriented towards pragmatism than towards the moonshot. I think most of the time, most entrepreneurs sin by being too heavy on the moonshot side and insufficiently heavy on the, okay, but what problem are you actually solving tomorrow for your customers that they're actually going to pay you for, right? What is the burning needs that you're solving for people right now? Like we all know that 30 years from now, you're going to be a $1 trillion company. What do you solve right now for your customers? And so I think that was the case here. It's like I had this stake on this problem where it's like, okay, people are collaborating differently. You know, I kind of take it for granted that 20, 30 years from now, they're all going to be collaboration tools that are huge that today just don't exist yet, right? So the work is changing, the nature of work, the nature of collaboration is changing. And there is this huge turn right now. It's kind of like in Formula One, the positions change during the turns. It's like there is this huge turn right now, which is COVID, and which is everybody is going remote and nobody knows how to deal with that, right? And so I think there was also this degree of opportunism here, which was let's just seize this rare moment and jump on it right now.
Well, to answer the point about how are people dealing with it, they're dealing with it by mass transitioning to Zoom and Slack. And as you said, you noticed the inadequacies of Zoom before COVID. But Zoom at a company level has been incredibly impressive at managing to onboard virtually everyone. So in the, let's just take it to January 2021, the articles come out, you're really launching. What was the problem that your average company was experiencing with Slack and Zoom? What were these tools not providing for?
100%. So, and to be clear, I have nothing against Zoom. I do think it's a very admirable company. So the way we think of the landscape is as a 2x2. It's unfortunate that this is audio, but you have informal communication, formal communication, and you have text communication and video communication, right? Text formal communication is like Google Docs or email, right? Text informal communication is a Slack or Microsoft Teams. Video formal communication is Zoom, WebEx, BlueJeans, Google Meet, all of that stuff. Video informal communication used to be the office, right? And we've lost that medium altogether. And we've tried to fill that gap with Zoom, with Slack, with email, with these three other quadrants of this 2x2, with tools that were never designed for that use case of informal video communication. And so again, I'm not saying there is anything with Zoom or Slack or anything. I think they do an amazing job at filling these respective quadrants. But what I do think is that you cannot work without this informal video communication quadrant. I think it is so important for work. It is so important for relationship building, for culture building. And I do think that it's funny because remote has changed everything about the way we work, but there is this unspoken assumption by a lot of people that we can keep using the exact same tools as we were using before. You know, we are using the same Slack, the same Zoom, everything is the same. And so my assumption is just that when you change everything about the way you work, you got to change a tool. You need new tools to fit this new way of working. So that's the gap we're filling, is this informal video quadrant. And so removing this very formal, very transactional dynamic to remote work.
Now, I'm curious, because like you said, it's not as if you specifically have beef with Slack or Zoom. It's that you're not quite happy, nor are frankly any of us happy with how they're operationalizing themselves. But what do you think about the narrative around especially Slack? So for example, how do you think of the idea of killing email? How has that side of it played out over the course of the usage for folks?
I mean, I don't know about you. Me, I'm kind of like an old curmudgeon like this. I nobody agrees with me. My team strongly disagrees with me. I really don't like Slack. I prefer email, 10x better. I think from a workflow standpoint, I also use Superhuman, unaffiliated, but such a good product. It's a really good product. And I just think Slack doesn't give me the same amount of power or productivity. It doesn't let me set reminders as quickly. And the signal to noise ratio is unbearable. It's just so much noise, and I lose everything all the time on Slack. And so I actually find that it makes me less focused and less productive, and more things fall through the cracks on Slack than did through email. So I really used to be a believer of this vision of Slack, and I think something somewhere went very wrong with Slack. And so I remain a very big believer in email, actually.
I actually am 100% with you around email. I think it's definitely a curmudgeonly thing, but I think there is something there. But I think that here's the part which is there, and I'm happy you hit on this because it leads into two separate questions about team flow. So number one would be, how do you create a workplace feature, tech platform, etc., that doesn't just feel like you're throwing another thing on someone's plate? So for context, before I was at OnDeck, I worked in the traditional Washington, D.C. think tank policy space, aka the least tech-oriented of any professional workplace I can imagine. And the first thing that hit me when I came to OnDeck is there were all these tools I had to use, and they're all great tools. There's no actual objection to them. But once again, like you said, I quickly was overwhelmed, and I know intellectually that X thing will improve my productivity by X percentage, but at a certain point, it's easy to retreat into curmudgeonness. And I think that outside of tech Twitter, I'm probably much more of the norm than not. So how do you create a workplace tool like TeamFlow that for most people isn't just going to feel like another thing to be added to their ever-growing stack of things to do?
Yeah. Oh, just to be clear, again, I have nothing against Zoom, but I do believe that for our paid customers and the majority of our users, we replace Zoom, right? So the way we think of TeamFlow is, again, it's a virtual office. And so in your virtual office, yes, you hang out with your team around the co-working area, but you also have your meetings, right? So the open office is both the open office floor plan and the meeting room, while Zoom is just the meeting room, right? So I do believe that we replace Zoom by supplementing it with the Hangout outside of the meeting, but at the end of the day, we also do own the meeting. And we do that by providing people with project rooms. And so there is another way that we don't exactly replace other tools, but we make it less painful to have a lot of tools at your belt by, you know, the advantage of having a virtual office is that you have infinite real estate. So you can create one room for projects that you have or per meeting that you have. And you can keep all the artifacts that go into that project or that meeting together in one place. And they persist. So when you leave the room and you come back for your next meeting about this project, all the artifacts that you need are together in one place. So in a way, again, it makes it so much less painful to have Figma and Notion and Google Docs and all of these tools because you just joined the project room and they're all here together. So we kind of act as the connective tissue between your applications.
So what's interesting about that is you're not countering what I'm saying. You're saying that the problem for all these tools is that they're not connected and you actually need to build a space that connects them. That's actually very interesting. My next question would be, can you walk us through the actual experience of using TeamFlow? Maybe on your team, because as you pointed out, you're in meetings all day, so you're probably not the right person, but just give us a generic worker. You wake up, you go to your computer screen. How does that process go from then on?
Yeah. So you wake up, you go to your computer screen, you open TeamFlow, just like some people open Slack or some people commute to work. You open TeamFlow, you walk to the middle of the co-working area. You can say hi to your team. So it's like a nice moment that you share with your team. Sometimes you have a little chit chat for 5 minutes, like, hey, what did you do last night? What's up? Maybe someone's like, hey, I was looking for you. Do you have 2 minutes to chat about this? Then, you know, you can work by yourself. You can either go to your own office to be by yourself, or you can co-work silently with the rest of your team around the open office. And then when you have meetings, you go to the project rooms. You enter it, all your content is here, you meet with people there, you take your notes there, you whiteboard tables there and all of that. And then towards the end of the day, you can join, for example, the game room or the cafeteria in your office where the rest of your team is hanging out, perhaps having a beer, and you can play games with them. So we have like Tetris games, we have Codenames games, we have drawing games and all of that stuff. So you can decontract with your team and build relationships with them like that at the end of the day. And then when you're done with your day, you can log off, which also addresses one of the pain points that people mentioned with remote, which is that they're having a harder time separating work and life, mm-hmm. right? Because it happens in the same space. Whereas I think with a virtual office, it actually makes for a much cleaner separation. Because when you're done with your work, you just close Teamflow, and now it actually feels like you're done with work.
Yeah. Something I'm wondering, when I'm thinking about your articulation of Teamflow, and once again, we're in the very early days, I'm reminded of the newspaper industry in the 1990s, in the sense that the immediate reaction of publishers like the New York Times or Washington Post was to, when they got on the internet, they just took the paper and then put it online. It was just the digital version of that same paper. You didn't actually lean into what the internet was. You didn't actually say, hey, how could this look different? This or that. So how do you think through the dangers, especially as you're attempting to scale, of just taking the virtual, the office experience that most of us, especially those who are postgraduate first few years in the workplace, how do you not just take those assumptions, paste them in the virtual format, and then possibly stagnate? Because I'm thinking, I can see that being a problem there. I guess a good way of putting it is like, what are some assumptions about the traditional office that you don't see translating well into our virtual conception of it?
Yeah, 100%. I think the big difference here is that the newspaper disappeared, right? And so at the end of the day, you're just left with this weird legacy thing on the internet. And you're like, why did we do this way? It's like, well, because there used to be this thing called the newspaper. Whereas in our case, the physical world is not going anywhere. Right, babies are still born in the physical world, and they can still see people around them, and they can only hear them if they're near them. And they have this concept of hanging out with people, even if they're not actively doing anything with them, just being in the same space as them. And so I think that this is a constant in human life, right? And so I actually think that bringing this to the virtual world is actually a progression, right? Not a reversal, right? And I actually think that today, the interaction mode with remote work has been historically optimized for the machine, not for the human. And by that, I mean today, by and large, the way people communicate today with remote is written communication, right? It's like Slack and email. The reason why it's written communication is not because people are better at writing and reading than they are at talking and hearing. In fact, they're much worse at talking than they are at talking, right? Most people are terrible writers, right? The reason why text dominates remote work is because that's best for the computer. Text is very easy for the computer to handle, right? That's the reason why the first few applications for the internet were text-based, right? Email and Usenet groups and all of that stuff, right? Video, on the other hand, is much better for people, right? Again, babies learn to talk and hear much earlier than they learn to write and read, right? It's a much more intuitive, much more deeply embedded thing inside our brains than writing or reading. Right. So video is 10x better for your brain. It's much more intuitive. It's much more human compatible, but just sucks for the computer. Right. It's live video encoding and uploading is about the hardest things that customers are asking from their computers. Right. Maybe if you train an AI model or if you run an AI model, maybe that's a strong contender, but you can feel it on your phone. If you record a 4K video on your phone's autonomy is no more than half an hour doing that kind of stuff because it's just so heavy on resources, right? So it's heavy for your GPU, it's heavy for your CPU, for your memory, it's heavy for your network, right? It's just super hard, right? So in a way, I always joke that we do video first, not because it's easy, but because it's hard, right? And so I really actually view it as an evolution in the way that teams collaborate in the future. And I actually view it as optimizing for the user and not for the computer.
Something I'm curious about is, we know the cost of in-person, and you've discussed this earlier, the commute, geographic limitations, COVID itself, really straightforward. What do you think, to play devil's advocate for a second, are the costs of our current, not quite there, remote first culture? Because I don't know anyone, and once again, this is the opportunity for you all at Teamflow, obviously. I don't know anyone that's happy with it right now. So what are the costs of that?
Yeah. I think it's very simple, and all the literature points in the same direction, which is that much lower productivity, right, and much worse relationships, much less fun at work, right? The productivity, I forgot the exact name of the paper. Perhaps I can link you to it after this. There is this paper that shows that when you co-locate people in the same space dedicated to a project, their productivity goes up by more than 2x. It more than doubles, which honestly is extremely congruent with my own experience. People often ask me, how did you move so fast with Teamflow? And honestly, it didn't feel heroic at the moment we were doing it. And I actually attributed to the fact that we were building Teamflow in Teamflow. At no moment was any of us ever blocked by anyone. You just ask, it's like, hey, Bob, like, what about this? And in 30 seconds, you're unblocked, right? So the productivity effects are dramatic. There is this famous research by researchers at MIT that finds that the greatest predictor of team performance is the number of face-to-face interactions outside of formal meetings, right? So that's the first thing. So the second thing is the impact on trust, relationship, and culture. And here again, there is a mountain of research all pointing in the same direction, which is that people just perceive each other as much more likable when they can see each other's face and hear each other's voice than when they can just read each other's will. I actually had an experience on this a few weeks ago that really brought this point home. Is I got in a Twitter fight with a guy, as one does, and I was super mad at him. And I went to my girlfriend. I was like, ah, this guy's just like super dumb. I hate him. And then she was like, wait, like don't get into a fight with him. Like, we're invited to his place for a dinner party on Friday. And I was like, uh-oh, like this is gonna be awkward. And actually, I met him in person on this Friday, and immediately he was like the nicest, most awesome guy I'd ever met, you know? And so I just think it's funny how we've observed that interactions on written media, like Twitter and Facebook, can become so toxic so quickly, right? Like the debates on these platforms are very, very bad, right? And we've decided for some reason to bring the same attributes to the workplace, right? And so I actually, again, view that as a regression. Right. So again, I think it's impact on productivity and its impact on trust, relationship, and culture.
How are you seeing a generational difference or response to Teamflow? Because something you helpfully got at was the fact that you and I are totally fine with email. So narratives around whether or not you hate email, narratives around whether or not Slack is awesome, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are really defined by different generations, different experiences, different expectations. How are you seeing this far in differences in those expectations or experiences?
Yeah, we see a slightly easier time selling Teamflow to younger crowds. I think because it has this slightly video game-ish aspect where you can customize your space. It's a little bit like in The Sims, you can move around and all of that stuff. But by and large, I think that it's a universal experience that the status quo is just not working, right? I think there is very little demographic segmentation around, for example, Zoom fatigue. Everybody is feeling Zoom fatigue, right? And so we're not seeing too heavy a demographic effect, perhaps slightly leaning towards the younger crowd.
Let's just get into what you've learned so far. So you'd spent a lot of time thinking about Teamflow, obviously, but really coming out of stealth mode earlier in the year, what's just been the experience like?
It's something, and still I'm still very early in my journey, so it's arrived. What's been the experience like so far? I think one of my main lessons has been, I think it's a quote from Frank Lloyd Wright that goes, you can use an eraser on the drafting board, or you can use a sledgehammer on the construction site. And so my bias is always to move fast. And I've actually realized that very often you could move faster by moving slower. That in the earliest stages of the project, when you're designing something, when you're brainstorming about something, that is when making the changes is cheapest. That is the best time to make changes. And so it's totally worth actually putting a project on hold for a few more weeks to really nail down some fundamental questions about the nature of the project, about the problem that you're solving. Like to spend a few more days or weeks talking with your users, right? Testing your ideas against them and all of that. And when you do it, it feels so, it's like, ah, why are we blocked again? Like, I really want to start building. Why are we blocked for one more week on that? But I actually think that by doing this, you save time on that.
Can you tell us some novel experiences and interactions that have come from the virtual office format? So for example, I met my co-founder / co-host of my podcast in the line on the way to Stuart orientation. That's something that only would have happened in the pre-COVID university system. Lots of people have stories founding a company with the person they walked across the, you know, worked across the desk from, other people meeting at the water cooler. How have you seen those types of novel experiences play out in Teamflow?
Yeah, there's one of our users. I was in his virtual office chatting with him, and he told me that he started at his company, which was like a small startup of like 25 people. He started there only 4 weeks before they started adopting Teamflow. And he told me that even though he had been at that small company for 4 weeks, it's only when they started using Teamflow that he met some of his coworkers for the first time. Mm. Right? Because he was a software engineer and some of his coworkers were, say, support agents, and he had no reason to interact with them. And when you arrive at a company, nobody is going to open Slack and click on every name there is and just say hi for no reason. But again, in a virtual office, when you see someone's face right around the corner, it's a very human, natural thing to drag yourself over to them and say hi. And again, that speaks to what I mentioned earlier, that the fact that she's tapping into deep human instincts that are not going anywhere, which is why I actually think it's progress, not regression. I mean, that's every single day I have interactions on Teamflow, and I'm like, this would never have happened without it. You know, it's like you are about to log off, and it's like 8, and you go to the middle of the open space, and you meet a few of your teammates, and then you start playing poker or whatnot. And it's completely serendipitous. Or perhaps just the other day, we were with the team in the open space, and one teammate was like, Flo, I'm starting to work on this. Like, how do you envision this work exactly? And I pulled up a whiteboard and I whiteboarded how I viewed it work. And then the designer chimed in, and then two engineers chimed in. And the whole interaction lasted 7 minutes. And during these 7 minutes, the whole team activated and the engineer wasn't blocked and could work on his thing. I have no doubt that without Teamflow, this would have taken 1 week of emails and Slack messages and meetings and wait, we're missing this person. We need to have another meeting here. It just took 7 minutes.
Something that I got excited about when you described actually going to the person's office, will your avatar in Teamflow travel different places with you? So let's say I've got my on-deck Teamflow and you and I we initially hopped on for this call actually in your office so we could see what this actually looked like. Is there a world where this would follow me different places and there's this broader virtual world you're navigating around?
Yeah, so you can be part of several different orgs, and we're actually building right now a way for you to share one room between two different offices. So if you have a partnership with another company, you can share one room with them and you keep all the artifacts related to that partnership in one place.
So the obvious question that I need to ask you at this point is, what do you think about Facebook Horizon workrooms with the Oculus VR goggles and just all, and no need to say anything negative. How do you think about the space that way?
I just think VR solves none of the problems that exist in collaboration. I think it could over the very long term, but I don't think it's there just yet. I think it's going to take 5 or 10 years for it to really work. I think there's a few different reasons for that. You know, the hardware isn't quite ready. The screens are not high resolution enough just yet to really display text and very high resolution documents. It's too heavy still. You know, it's kind of unwieldy. It's not as convenient as just popping out your laptop to like put a VR headset on your computer. I'm sorry, but you kind of look like a dork with a VR headset on, and nobody likes that. You're disconnected from your environment. Nobody likes that, right? And then one final huge factor is that all our workflows are on desktop, and these are super sticky. And even assuming that VR was an objectively superior medium, which I don't think it is, but even if it was, our apps today are designed for desktop, and it's going to take us decades, literally decades, before we actually rebuild them in a VR-first way. In the same way that it is actually taking us decades to rebuild everything in a touch-first way, you know, mobile-first, iPad-first. You know, people have been predicting the rise of the tablet in the workplace for a decade, and here we are still using our desktops. You know, and I would love using my iPad at work, but the truth is that my applications are on my desktop, and my peripherals, my hardware, is built on desktop. So I think there is just a very, very long half-life here. And I'm hugely bullish on desktop, actually, for the future of work, for, frankly, the foreseeable future.
I would love for you to talk about your desktop bullishness, because I'm recording this on a Microsoft Surface right now, but one of the first things I did when I moved and actually got settled is I bought a desktop computer for the first time in 15 years. I haven't done this since I was a freshman in high school. So just talk more about the desktop part, because I just keep seeing this pop up in different parts. I'm curious how you think about it.
Yeah, I actually think like the desktop is having a revival. So to be fair, when I say desktop, I include the laptop in there. I mean like desktop computers, but actually desktop are having a revival now. And paradoxically, I think that is because of the rise of remote work, which is that you're not mulling your laptop from room to room anymore. You're actually staying at the same workstation all day. And so it has become worth it to optimize for the comfort at that one workstation versus optimizing for portability of that workstation. I'm kind of hybrid. I think most people are, in that I have a huge, I have like a 49-inch monitor at my desk, and I plug it to my laptop, and then I have like a third-party keyboard and mice. So I really think that desktop is going to be with us for the foreseeable future. And yeah, to your point, it's actually increasing, not decreasing over time.
Yeah, it's just funny because it goes to your point around folks liking having a separate work-life balance. And I love having because the desktop is in the workroom. It's in the workroom. The workroom is separate from the hangout room. It's separate from the bedroom. And there's just something really funny and useful there. So to follow up on the Facebook workplace stuff, though, I'm curious, did you see more interest in the space after the announcement? Because I doubt everyone is making the distinction between the VR version and just any type of virtual office scenario.
No. And I mean, the interest in the space has been high and is remaining high. I think this made a big splash and everybody asked me about it for 1 week. And then that was it. I don't know if you've tried the product or if you're like a big VR guy. I have a few VR headsets myself. And I think they make for cool demos. I think a pretty universal experience with VR headsets today is that they gather dust in the drawer. And that is certainly my experience. And I wouldn't sell my VR headset for anything in the world because I love the object. And again, I love the demos. Anytime I have friends over at home, I show them the VR headset and I let them put it on and try it. But realistically, very few people use it on a daily basis.
And did the announcement drive any interest in TeamFlow? I'm curious.
A little bit, not too much. Like some reporters reached out and asked me this exact question about what's your take on this product. But no, it didn't make a huge difference.
Something I'm wondering about, especially when Facebook enters into a space, how zero sum is the future of workplace space? Because what's so interesting for me as someone who works at multiple companies, does different things, is I have Slack, got Zoom for recording. I need to start using Riverside for those recordings. There's Hopin for virtual events. There's all these different spaces. And what I find so interesting about what you all have done is that you've actually leaned into the virtual aspect of that. And I can imagine all these different ways that I could have my on-deck office and maybe there's a recording studio and maybe there's an event space because on-deck obviously does cohort-based education. There are just so many different functions that I could see centralizing, but at the same time, the space is very decentralized. So how do you just think about centralization and decentralization when work is both an expansive category, but the actual experience is actually pretty stacked? Once again, like you said earlier, it just isn't really well knitted together.
Yeah. So it's funny because I think there's two forces here pulling in different directions, right? One is I think there is always room for software to create more value. And I think that the willingness to pay of people for software is actually increasing. And I actually think that Superhuman is a great example of that. Mighty is another one. People are actually willing now to pay $400 a year for an email client or for a web browser, products that you could get for free. But it's just that these products are so important today in our lives that there is room for growth in the size of the market. if that makes sense. Because now even small subsegments of the population, like the power user, that superhuman and mighty or addressing, even these subsegments are big enough and have enough willingness to pay to justify the existence of I think, credit big companies, right? So that's happening on the one hand. On the other hand, though, I think it's John Luttig from Founders Fund who wrote a blog post that's called When Tailwind Vanishes. And one of the points, I believe it is in that blog post, where he says that, look, we're kind of at saturation, meaning you're using your laptop all day, every day at work. It's not like there is room left to take in your day, right? So unavoidably, when you use a new tool, it kind of comes at the expense of an existing tool in terms of minutes or hours of use, right? And not only is there that, but there is the other thing that you alluded to earlier, which is new tool fatigue. Even if there was room in your life for more tools, people don't want to use more tools. And so you actually start to see tools which value prop is, well, the app to bring them all together. ClickUp does that. Notion kind of does that. If you look at their homepage, like we'll replace Evernote and Google Docs and Jira, Asana and Trello and all of that stuff. And so it's not as good as any of these tools in doing what these tools do, but it does it all. And I think for a lot of people, that's a price of pressure. My take about how these two opposing forces will end up is that on the margin, we're going to see some expansion. We're going to see more and more cloud companies, bigger and bigger cloud companies. But I don't think the expansion in number of collaboration tools that we use on a daily basis in the next 10 years is going to be anywhere close to what it's been for the last 10 years.
Yeah, so two last questions here. So number one, I read Packy McCormick's really great investment memo on TeamFlow. Packy's been on the show. For any listeners who haven't checked that out yet, I suggest that everyone go read the memo after this episode. We'll link it in the show notes, of course. An idea that really fascinated me was someone in the piece, I'm not sure if it's Packy or not, referenced the idea that the shift to remote could unlock ridiculous amounts of value in the same way that the adoption of the iPhone and the shift from desktop computing, despite everything we just talked about, to mobile actually opened up all this different value there. So when you hear that articulation of that, obviously you're venture backed, so you're talking about the bigger vision. Just talk about the bigger vision for this space as you think about it.
Oh, I literally think that remote is the most important economic transition since the Industrial Revolution. It's, you know, in history, there has never been a time when so many companies changed the way they worked so drastically and so suddenly, right? It just hasn't happened in economic history, right? It's a more sudden and more significant shift, I think, than even the Industrial Revolution, right? So, yeah, it's hard to overstate the impact it's going to have because the second order effects are absolutely enormous. And there are several studies. One of them was co-led by Citrix that found that the impact of remote on just the American economy can be upwards of $2 trillion a year, right? There are papers, just to list the kind of second order effects that we're talking about. One significant headwind into the American economy has been housing policy, right? Cities are the most amazing tools for economic growth on the one hand, but on the other hand, we've actually curtailed the ability of cities to grow because we've basically outlawed building new housing in cities for a bunch of reasons. You know, it's called like NIMBYism, and that's especially salient in California, but that exists everywhere in the world, you know? And some papers have actually found that if you lifted housing restrictions in the US, the American GDP would go up by at least 10%. And actually, some revisions to the paper have found, no, actually, that's wrong. There are some mistakes in the paper. It's much more than 10%. I mean, just for context, that means that the average household would make an extra $6,000 a year. And, you know, the average tech worker would make an extra $15,000 a year. That's significant, right? And so I think that remote is the non-obvious solution to this limit in housing building, because now you don't need to be in a city anymore to access the city's labor market, right? The other thing is a bunch of papers have found that when you grow a city's labor market, its productivity grew you know, when you grow cities labor market by 10%, the productivity grows by 2% because the market is stickier, because there's better allocation and all of that. What happens when you grow labor market by 1,000,000%? What happens when you create the first city in the world, which is the city in the cloud, which is going to be 2 billion people? What happens when all of a sudden any employer can hire people, not just in the 20 miles radius from them, but anywhere in the world, and vice versa? Any employee can apply to jobs, not just in the 20 miles radius from them, but anywhere in the world. What happens to immigration policy? Right, like we've been fighting in this country for the last 100 years about how many people do we let in the country and from what countries, right? All of a sudden, that's made completely irrelevant by remote. For the first time of my adult life, I'm working in a company where nobody is on a visa. At Uber, more than 70% of my team was on a visa. At Teamflow, less than half the team is in the US and nobody is on a visa and nobody cares about that. I cannot tell you how huge of a difference that makes in people's lives. Right. I mean, I could go on and on, just like saving 1.5 hours in commute on average per person. Again, trillions and trillions of dollars of value. So I really strongly believe that the shift to remote is a very underappreciated phenomenon.
So the last question here would be, what do you advise people who are thinking about those last real clear benefits of in-person? So it's funny, you were dunking on the commute, but I actually miss the 30, 40 minute commute. It's how I listened to my podcast. It's how I listened to my Audible book reading. It's how I turned off from work, which is always good. And at the same time, also, you know, if I were 22, 23, like that's where people meet their friends post-college, just where they meet significant others most of the time. How do you advise people, if the world moves the direction that it's moving, how do you advise people think through how they should solve for those issues they're going to have come up with them?
I think it's actually going to create another tailwind for tech. I think that more and more of these functions that were served by the real world are actually going to be served by the internet. And I think people are going to create these relationships on Clubhouse and Reddit and other social media. I think people are going to be more deliberate about building these relationships too. And I think it's going to create better assortative mating, if you will, between friends, right? I think that matching of people and matching of friends is going to be less and less random because the real world is a bit random. There's like non-random components about, you know, they work with you, they're kind of like the same education level, but still pseudo-random. And I think it's going to be increasingly segregated around interest lines. So, again, I think bigger and bigger online communities is going to be a big part of the answer here.
That's a really good answer and a great one to end it. I was going to say last question, but I'm going to ask you this because it'll be useful for people. You're very well read. You clearly are very well read. How did that come about? How did you suggest that other people, you know, it's the name of the show, so I don't want to be too much of a hack here, but you're deep. How did you become deep, and how do you advise other people work to become deep?
I don't know. I would recommend people to set themselves an objective, honestly, to begin with one book per week. And I am for 2 or 3 books per week. And it's just, I think many people assume that if they don't love it, they're doing it wrong. It's like, it's not for me, because people read a ton like that, they love it. And there is a dimension on which you love it. I think it's a deep curiosity that develops, right? But at the end of the day, when you're in the middle of reading, it's not like the most pleasant experience, just whatever, right? But like little by little, it does feed that curiosity on a very deep level. I would also urge people to give up on books a lot more than they do. I think 90% of books are not good, and I give up on at least 90% of books I start, right? After half an hour on a book, if I'm not hooked, I'm not hooked, and I give up. I think time is much too precious to give it to the 90% of books that are not good. And so if you think about this 90% books probability, it means that if you read 3 books, you have a 73% chance of these 3 books being bad, if 90% of each book is bad. Right. And so that's a very high probability. And so for most people, it's just enough to conclude that they don't like reading. You know, they're going to sometimes read one book they really like, but by and large, they don't like reading. It's like, sure, you know, because you don't give up enough on books. So you should give up on a lot of books and just read stuff that really gets you going.
It's a perfect place to end. Flo, thank you so much for coming on The Deep End. Do you have anywhere you should direct folks who are really interested in your work to go check out?
I'm on Twitter, at Timo. That's where I just go stream of consciousness all day, A-L-T-I-M-O-O. Otherwise, I also have a blog that's linked there in the bio.
Great. Well, thank you for joining. We appreciate the time.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thanks for joining us in the Deep End. If you enjoyed your stay, give us a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode with your friends and colleagues to help grow the show with us. We've also got show notes and more episodes available at ideas.beyonddeck.com. See you next time.